Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. It's not a mystery episode, but I can't introduce the topic of this episode just yet because we're going to start out with a case, and it's a mystery case. If I told you what the podcast was about, the case would be given away, and it's just a whole problem. On the other end of the line, I have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, dude?
Hey, just wrapped up a couple weeks of work in the hospital, feeling good, and it just sounds like you're all about the mystery now. not even a title and a topic.
I know, yeah. Like, you're supposed to give people like the lead in to make sure they keep listening. But I think if you tell them there's going to be a cool medical mystery case that will lead you through, you know, some interesting information, maybe they'll stick around. We'll see. We'll see if the listenership drops off, you know, after the 30 seconds.
I don't know. It seems like that's been the case lately. People have liked them, so.
Give the people what they want. That's what we do. So let's just hop right into the case, and then we can do some happy talk afterwards and whatever. But I'm excited about this one. All right.
Okay.
You ready? You ready for this?
All right. Let's do it.
All right. So here's a case to introduce the topic of this podcast. So 29-year-old male presents to the emergency room via ambulance. His mother found him down in the bathroom convulsing and called, this is interesting, called 119. This case is actually from Korea, and they don't, it's not 911, it's 119, which is great that they kept it like, you know, similar. So according to mom, the patient had abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and headaches prior to the convulsions. He had gone to the bathroom when she heard loud noises and went to check on him, subsequently finding him down having convulsions, which she describes as large involuntary movements of his arms and legs. She does not know for how long these movements went on for, but when they stopped, the patient was profoundly weak and unable to answer her questions. She does not know if he lost consciousness. His past medical history is significant for a splenectomy due to a motor vehicle accident and a recent history of smoking, although unknown amount and duration. His mom thinks that he might have quit a few days ago. His vital signs are significant for an elevated blood pressure, 135 over 48, a low temperature, 35.1 degrees Celsius, 95.1 for our American friends who still are stuck with Fahrenheit. But his heart rate, respiratory rate, and his oxygen saturation were all normal on room air. Now, I know I just word dumped to you, but what are you thinking about here, Dr. B?
Yeah, that was a whole lot of information. So first of all, I'm alarmed at this patient's presentation. He sounds what we would call sick. Somebody who is found down like this in general, again, as I tend to do, ignoring everything that you told me. Somebody's found down, we tend to worry about cardiovascular catastrophe would be, you know, high on the list. Neurological catastrophe would also be high on the list. And then in younger patients like this, and with some of the other data that you provided, some kind of either toxic related complication, metabolic related complication would be kind of the first pass of things that we're going through. And so, you know, on immediate evaluation of somebody like this, we want to get a sense of, yeah, their vital signs. That was super useful to get a sense of a quick neurological exam, see what's going on there, give this patient some glucose, some Narcan if they're unresponsive, things like that to try to stabilize the most immediately reversible causes and some of the most highly morbid things in the short term. So this is thinking more in ER doctor mode, which of course I am not one, but that would be the initial management when somebody like this shows up, making sure that their breathing is all right, their circulation, their airways secured or functioning okay. The story that you gave sounds an awful lot like a seizure. I hesitate to put a final stamp of that label on the patient, but this episode, this acute convulsive episode followed by a bout of kind of minimal or reduced responsiveness would be pretty common for a seizure. The question though would be, is this a primary seizure from, you know, somebody having epilepsy, for example, which you would expect, you know, somebody like this might have a history of something like that, or is this a secondary seizure from something else causing it, from some sort of neurological condition, from a systemic disease, or from a drug or toxic related exposure? The other little tidbit of history that raises a rather large red flag is the splenectomy. So any of the medical students or trainees audience will recognize splenectomy, having had your spleen taken out, results in a degree of immune compromise, and that can lead predispose patients to catastrophic, life-threatening infection if they're not appropriately immunized. And if oftentimes these patients are counseled pretty clearly of, like, if you have any sign or symptom of fever or infection, you know, that's something to get checked out. So then could there be something infectious going on here? We don't have enough story about how this patient was doing before this episode to have a sense of that. And then this smoking history. So then the question is, was there some kind of toxic exposure from the smoke? What is making his mom say that she thinks he quit a few days ago? Was he substituting? Was he previously a smoker? And then he decided to try to quit smoking by substituting it with something else, or using some other type of a substance that could lead to this kind of a complication. So zooming way back out, big picture. You know, adult found down, cardiovascular, neurologic, toxic, metabolic type things, emergent stabilization, which seems to have been done, or at least he seems to be relatively stable aside from wanting to know a little bit more about his neurological status, making sure he's not infected, and then treating any reversible causes while I get more history and lab investigation and such.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, you didn't ask for it, but I'm going to tell you anyway. During transport, he got a finger stick. His blood glucose was normal. And then upon arrival to the emergency department, he was conscious and alert. He's able to give a history and is moving all of his extremities well. No apparent deficits. He said, yeah, he quit smoking a few days ago, as you asked about that. And he's been using some nicotine gum. He thinks they're 2 milligrams. And he's been using 4 or 5 of those once or twice per day for about 4 days. And overall, your physical exam is unremarkable. So, you know, being the clinician that you are, you're probably looking at some labs in the electronic medical record to see, like, what's been done, get a better sense for this. So I'll give you the labs before I even ask you to go further. So again, they recheck blood glucose because they don't trust the transport. And blood glucose was normal. His white count was elevated to 14.8. His lactic acid was 6.4. His prolactin was 119. The normal level of that is 3 to 25 nanograms per milliliter. You got a chest x-ray because you're in the ED and you're not getting past there without a chest x-ray. That's clear. Mm-hmm. You also got a head CT because if you're found down, you're going to get a head CT. That was also clear. So what you thinking?
Yeah. So it is, I don't know what the time of transport was or the interval between when this episode happened and when he got to the lab. It is interesting. You know, a lot of these labs could fit with somebody who had a seizure. And so it's just interesting that they remain this elevated. A lactate in the 6s is still quite high. The prolactin is sometimes something people check if they suspect that a recent seizure happened. It's, you know, if you have a super clear, compelling history, it's not necessary, but they got that anyway. And the elevated white blood cell count is not really specific for anything. It can go up in times of stress in general. It can represent a response to infection or inflammation in general, or come from some other less likely causes here. So all of this, I mean, these labs so far don't really help me narrow down a ton more beyond what I already thought was going on, that this individual had probably had a seizure at home. And again, I'm back to my previous kind of breakdown of what could have caused this seizure. The head CT not showing us anything obvious means that he doesn't have any blood in his brain. That's the no blood and no fracture. That's the best thing that the head CT can tell us, but it can miss a lot of things in the brain tissue itself. So I wouldn't be surprised if this individual also ended up getting a brain MRI at some point to look for some other cause of seizure within his brain. But the rest of the causes would be toxic in this individual. So I'm curious about this specific nicotine gum product. If that is in fact the amount of dosage that he's been using, I'd be looking more into, you know, what can be the manifestations of nicotine toxicity. Again, co-ingestions, contamination, things like that, that could be contributing to something like this. And then it sounds like the rest of the basic lab workup was pretty reassuring. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah. So in fact, while he was, you know, waiting to get that brain MRI, just about 2 hours after he showed up to the ED, the patient deteriorated. He was no longer conscious or responsive to pain stimuli. His oxygen levels fell to 54% on room air. He was intubated and ventilated and then admitted to the intensive care unit. Somebody thought to send a blood cotinine level, which is a metabolite of nicotine, and it was 3,491 nanograms per milliliter, and the reference is less than 25. Any thoughts here as to maybe what's going on?
It sounds like we were on the right track thinking toxic in this individual. Sounds like he has nicotine toxicity going on, which again is an intoxication that I'm not intimately familiar with, but all in all, you know, overall, this presentation makes sense and would fit that picture. And as we discussed in our last episode, when we had the caffeine intoxication, this is something that you'd be on the line with poison control to get further toxicologic guidance on. But a pretty unfortunate outcome that he deteriorated like this. Interesting that he had that kind of like semi-normal looking interval in between, because you would presume that his level did not decrease during that period of time. He remained nicotine toxic throughout the episode. So other, you know, in general, good supportive care, making sure his electrocardiogram looks okay, and then getting toxicologic expertise would be the next most useful steps here.
Yep. The patient remained intubated overnight. On hospital day two, the patient woke up and his respiratory status improved. He was extubated, so was off the ventilator on day three, and he was discharged on day five without any further sequelae. He did, however, when asked about nicotine exposure, he related that prior to this episode, he consumed 15 of the nicotine gums at once, which is a much higher dose, approximately 30 milligrams of nicotine at once, and then subsequently had this episode.
So, look, sometimes you got to go big, you know?
Yeah, there you go. So, hey, on this podcast, no surprise, we're going to be talking about nicotine use and its effect on health and performance. We get this question all the time, you know, hey, is nicotine bad? Like, most people are pretty clear that smoking in and of itself is bad. I don't know that we get questions on like, hey, is smoking still bad? Or has there been like an update to the evidence? People don't generally ask that, but there's some curiosity around other vehicles for nicotine delivery, whether it's vaping, whether it's smokeless tobacco, whether it's some of these other products like snus or even just synthetic nicotine or Zyn, for example, these other sort of ways that people can get nicotine in their systems.
Well, just pause you for one moment. This reminds me of some cases that I saw in the past in training where it was not necessarily nicotine related, but people using synthetic cannabinoids like spice and things like that, which I've seen horrific neurological complications from that. People who were, you know, needed to get intubated, sedated, put on a ventilator, and they're just like raging and bucking against the ventilator despite like multiple sedative agents and things like that, just because of what the spice does to their neurological system and leading to, you know, these sorts of convulsions and getting rhabdo from the convulsions and things like that. So it's been seen that on the non-nicotine end of the spectrum, but similarly would be on the list of things if he decided to replace his smoking with some other form of, you know, a similar activity that had a different substance involved. That's something else that could manifest like this.
Good job. Congratulations. All right. So to intro this podcast, we talk about like what is nicotine and different ways to get it. Obviously, tobacco smoking is a big problem in public health. It results in more than 5 million deaths each year globally. Nearly 1 million in addition to that are estimated to die from exposure to secondhand smoke. Despite these huge public health efforts on smoking cessation and avoiding smoking in the first place, fully 14% of adults in America, or about 34.1 million people, still smoke. The good news is that this is at an all-time low, and it's been on the decline since about the 1960s, when almost half of adults in America smoked. The bad news, though, is there's been a rise in use of other nicotine and non-cigarette tobacco products, so things like e-cigarettes, smokeless tobacco, and similar. So, for example, from 2011 to 2019, the use of electronic cigarettes among children has increased over 1,500%, with almost 3 million children initiating e-cigarette use in 2019 alone. Fully 30% of high school students report use of a tobacco product. As might be expected, habitual tobacco use is associated with diseases of the airways, so things like lung, the larynx, mouth cancers, COPD, and asthma. And cigarette smoking, as most people know, is responsible for a lot of lung cancers, up to 90% of all lung cancers in the United States, with more people dying from the smoking-related disease than any other type of cancer. And then there's tobacco smoking and e-cigarette use, which is also a major cause of other systemic diseases like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Austin, if you had to estimate, how many patients do you see, when you're in the hospital that are there due to like a smoking-related or smoking-associated type issue?
Tough to put a number on it, but it is a lot. Whether in terms of manifestations like cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, heart attacks, strokes, things like that, or peripheral vascular disease, meaning, you know, disease affecting the arteries of the limbs, mainly the legs and other organ systems, or COPD, chronic smoking-related lung disease, is extremely common. See that on a near daily basis. And then finally, cancers like new or known presentations of patients with lung cancer that's related to smoking. Those are probably among the highest, most common things that I would see patients for who have a smoking history or are continuing to smoke.
Yeah, and certainly a complication for other reasons why someone might be there. For example, someone has like a lung infection, they're there for pneumonia, but they also happen to be a smoker.
Yeah, they were predisposed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So before we actually talk about the effect of smoking, use of smokeless tobacco and nicotine use in general and their effects on health and performance, let's talk about like what nicotine is and what it does in the body. So nicotine is a naturally occurring component in tobacco leaves. That's Nicotiana tobacum. Chemically, nicotine is classified as an alkaloid. Now, Austin, being a resident chemist, you get excited. You've seen his eyes light up. But that just means it contains a nitrogen in its ring structure and it originates from an amino acid. In this regard, morphine is also an alkaloid. Now, consumption patterns, including smoking, so cigarettes, cigars, pipes, but you can also get it through smokeless tobacco, but there's many different forms of this. So, for example, there's chewing tobacco, which creates salivation and need for spitting. That's usually moist form of chewing tobacco. There's also snus, which is placed under the lip without the need for spitting. And then there's a dry powdered form of smokeless tobacco called snuff, and that's inhaled through the nose. There's also nicotine replacement therapies. So there's gum, there's transdermal patches put on your skin, nasal sprays, inhalers, lozenges, tablets, etc. There are a lot of different ways to get nicotine, and we should differentiate between those and tobacco, and certainly in tobacco between smokeless and smoked tobacco. But nicotine also naturally occurs in some edible plants, mostly nightshades, but things like cauliflower, potatoes, tomatoes. But these are very, very low concentrations, and so it's super unlikely that somebody's going to get a big enough dose of nicotine from those foods to actually, you know, raise their blood nicotine levels to something that could cause an effect. So speaking of an effect, what happens to nicotine once it's in our system? Now, depending on the vehicle of delivery or how you get it, nicotine is rapidly absorbed through some sort of tissue in the body. So it's absorbed through the lung tissue, the alveolar surface when it's smoked, through the oral mucosa, so in your mouth when using smokeless tobacco or oral nicotine replacement therapies, across the skin with a transdermal patch, and in the intestinal mucosa when swallowed. Now, the absorption of nicotine across biological membranes is dependent on the pH. So smokeless tobacco and nicotine replacement therapies are usually buffered to become a little more basic to facilitate oral and other types of absorption through the gastrointestinal tract, whereas inhaled smoke is more acidic and has little oral absorption, so nothing really in the mouth, and the majority of the absorption occurs in the lungs. Regardless of anatomical site, however, the nicotine ends up in the bloodstream. And once in the blood, these blood concentrations of nicotine rise quickly, particularly with smoking, peaking in minutes, likely faster due to the large surface area of the lung and the pH in the airways. In fact, after a puff, a single puff from a cigarette or a cigar, nicotine hits the brain in about 10 to 20 seconds, which is actually faster than IV administration. Austin, have you ever seen somebody get IV nicotine in the hospital?
I have never seen such a thing.
I've seen IV caffeine, and I'm infinitely jealous of, I want that.
I don't know what you would use IV nicotine for. I've used IV caffeine a couple times in adults, but that's uncommon. But nicotine, no.
Yeah, I've seen it in a lot of the research studies I read for this in preparing for this particular podcast, where they infuse people continuously with nicotine just to like see what happens. Mm. But I've not seen that obviously in the hospital. Interestingly, people kind of can self-modulate their nicotine exposure with smoking based on the volume of smoke that they take in, the depth of inhalation, the rate of puffing, etc. So people are able to like titrate the dose to effect. But compared to that relatively quick and high peak, smokeless tobacco is much lower and takes longer to peak, about 30 minutes. That's the same with nicotine replacement therapy. So whether it's a gum, patch, nasal spray, those are also slower to peak and reach lower peak levels depending on the dose when compared to smoking. I will say that the nasal spray, there's some evidence showing that it is similar in speed to smoking, but the dose being absorbed is lower. So, you know, some people might prefer that because it hits faster, although you have to like use more of it to get to the same level as a cigarette. Nicotine is metabolized into a number of different metabolites. As I recall reading, it's like six major metabolites, but the main one that you need to know about, 70 to 80% of nicotine goes into this metabolite called cotinine. And it occurs via two steps that are relatively unimportant here. You just need to know that it happens in the liver. That's the first step. And then the second step takes place within the cell itself. Now, the half-life of nicotine is about 1 to 2 hours. It takes about 1 to 2 hours for your liver to do its thing and then to be eliminated through the kidney. Again, most of this is metabolized into cotinine, and that actually is the biomarker used to detect sort of nicotine exposure, because that half-life is much longer, about 16 hours. And it should be noted that levels of either cotinine or nicotine in the blood are markedly affected by individual differences in nutrition, age, sex, medication use, ethnicity, genetics, and so on. So it's hard to actually predict sort of exposure and blood level based on some sort of exposure due to those differences. Although nicotine itself doesn't appear to be carcinogenic, which is a fancy way of saying like cancer-causing, it can be toxic at high doses, as seen in our opening case, and especially because there are many alternatives to smoking. Such as e-cigarettes, nicotine patches, nicotine candies, chewing gums are available, perhaps making toxic exposure more likely. This is similar to the caffeine sort of thing we went over. It's like you can't drink enough coffee really to overdose, because you'll die of water intoxication first. But caffeine tablets, on the other hand, represent a potential toxic exposure risk.
Tough to smoke enough cigarettes to get toxic on nicotine compared with stuffing your mouth with 40 pieces of nicotine gum and then you seize.
Totally. Yeah. Still, toxic exposure is relatively rare. There's about 40,000 cases of toxic exposure to tobacco and nicotine products in the United States that have been reported in the past 5 years, of which only 28 were considered severe. So that's less than 0.1%, basically requiring inpatient admission and supportive care to be administered in the hospital. All right. So that's like what nicotine is and how it's metabolized. But what does it do once it's in the bloodstream? So once nicotine's in the bloodstream, it binds to what's called a nicotine acetylcholine receptor, affecting the autonomic nervous system, the central nervous system, and the motor nervous system. And so that kind of requires us to do a little brief anatomy lesson of the nervous system. So the central nervous system consists of the brain and spinal cord. Most people are familiar with that. In addition to the central nervous system, you have a peripheral nervous system. Those are all the nerves outside of the brain and spinal cord that supply the rest of the body. So tissues, organs, skin, muscle, etc. The peripheral nervous system is further split into two separate nervous systems. One is called the autonomic nervous system. That's the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems. Sympathetic nervous system, you might be familiar as being referred to as the fight or flight sort of system. And then the parasympathetic nervous system is the rest and digest sort of actions. And then the second category is the somatic nervous system, which is sensory and motor sort of nerves. So for sensing touch and movement, basically. Now, nicotine in the blood binds to these nicotine acetylcholine receptors in all of these locations, thereby creating this sort of downstream effect. And as you may have guessed, these receptors are widely distributed throughout the body, but the majority of the effects of nicotine are mediated through receptors in the brain, known as central effects. In the brain, nicotine binds to the receptors on nerve cells, causing a change in the function of that cell by altering ion channel function. Together, these changes from nicotine binding its receptor produce a number of different effects, but the main one we'll focus on are changes in neurotransmitter release, specifically dopamine, serotonin, and catecholamines like noradrenaline in areas of the brain concerned with reward, motivation, learning, emotion, and so on. Exposure to nicotine affects these receptors in other ways too, sort of by acting as this like chaperone, which ultimately increases the density of these receptors on cells in susceptible individuals and decreasing their sensitivity to nicotine, thereby potentially leading to a pathway of dependence in susceptible individuals. So for example, recent research has shown that about 70% of the variability in nicotine dependence and smoking persistence can be attributed to genetic differences. And twin studies further kind of corroborate that, showing that about half of the individual differences contributing to smoking relapse are inherited. There's also some differential effects with different metabolites and additives in various tobacco products, particularly flavorings, seem to play a role in dependence as well. We should not underestimate the complexity of nicotine's actions. This is a, you know, maybe that 100,000 foot overview of like what nicotine does, but this is a very brief like summary of nicotine's effects and how it does the stuff. It's just an oversimplification highlighting how nicotine works. And we should also say that nicotine works in the periphery, so outside the brain, tending to affect circulation through vasoconstriction, increase in heart rate, things of that nature, affecting organs like the adrenal glands to kind of dump sort of stimulant type hormones into the blood system. Now, with that out of the way, let's talk about what nicotine exposure does in humans with respect to health. So what are the risks of nicotine use? We'll start with smoking. With respect to health, cigarette smoking is like the leading preventable cause of mortality. It's responsible for over 7 million deaths worldwide and over 480,000 deaths in the United States every year. Now, the three major causes of smoking-related death are atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, that's a fancy way of saying heart disease, cancer, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Also significantly increases risk of other lung disease or complications of existing lung disease that people have, diabetes risk, osteoporosis, and more. Now, the pathophysiology of smoking is complex, as it's not just related to nicotine ingestion in and of itself. Rather, there are many different substances. One paper I pulled said there's over 9,000 different chemicals that you get from smoking a cigarette. So it's, you know, each of those have their own subsequent effects. So we can't blame this all on nicotine. It's just nicotine seems to be the psychoactive molecule that is involved with the behavior of smoking. Still, we know that many of these substances, particularly when burned and inhaled, are toxic, potentially leading to cellular damage, mutations in cellular DNA, and overall dysfunction. On a more macro level, smoking leads to constriction of the blood vessels, especially in the heart, increased tendency of the blood to clot, negative changes in blood lipid levels, increases in inflammation, dysfunction in the cells lining the blood vessels, those are called endothelial cells, and much, much more. Surprise, smoking isn't health promoting. I don't know that anybody was like waiting for that, but we know that to be the case. I mean, cigarette smoking is responsible for over 10% of all cardiovascular disease related deaths worldwide, 33% in the United States. Cancer risk for many types, most notably lung, head and neck, GI tract, et cetera, are all increased with smoking. Fortunately, after quitting, there's a pretty rapid reduction in risk of cardiovascular disease from smoking. Cancer risk tends to decrease more gradually, by about half at about 10 to 15 years after smoking cessation. It also reduces the risk of a second cancer in those who already have cancer, even if it's due to smoking in the first place. The health risks are even seen from smoking with relatively low levels of smoking. So people who smoke, you know, 1, 2, 3 cigarettes per day. People smoking 1 to 10 cigarettes per day were over twice as likely to develop a smoking-related cancer than non-smokers. It's also not clear if reducing cigarette smoking from a higher to lower level is associated with improved outcomes, which is not surprising to find because when you try to create big data sets, you're going to have people with all sorts of different exposure risks. People smoking 1 pack a day, 2 packs a day, 1/2 pack a day. And, you know, you might not expect that going from 1/2 pack a day to 1/4 pack a day to make a big difference, but going from 2 packs a day to 1/2 pack a day, you would likely predict some sort of harm reduction. So it's just kind of messy in there.
It's similar to a lot of the nutrition discussion that we've talked about with high versus low. How much is high? How much is low? And then, you know, what size data set do you need to show a difference between the two? And so that a lot of this ends up coming out in the wash in this data is not surprising to me, but also does not dissuade me from trying to take somebody who smokes a lot and get them to smoke less. Because I still, seems rather straightforward that that would be better for them than continuing to smoke more.
Yeah, it's certainly not worse. Yeah. To like start smoking less. Yeah. But unsurprisingly, we recommend against smoking in those who do not currently smoke and smoking cessation in those who do currently smoke. Those who stop smoking can be expected to live longer and are less likely to develop tobacco-related diseases. And people also benefit from quitting smoking even after the development of smoking-related diseases. So even if you already have coronary heart disease or COPD or something else that's attributed to smoking, smoking even after that seems to improve sort of not only health trajectory, but the burden of disease from those things. So again, big surprise. We don't recommend smoking. I don't know that anybody was like waiting for that punchline, but if you were, here you go. Vaping is more interesting to me because this is definitely on the rise. And it's another method of not only nicotine ingestion, but other potential sort of adulterants or contaminants, or we'll just say things that are included in the vape juice, as it were. But vaping is another way that people can get nicotine. It's when a battery-operated device heats nicotine containing liquid to produce an aerosol that the individual inhales. Now, the liquid is heated to produce this aerosol that, again, contains nicotine and other stuff with some carcinogenic potential. In 2021, the prevalence of e-cigarette use was 4.5% among United States adults, according to the National Health Interview Survey, which has increased markedly in recent years. But there's not really much data on long-term health effects of e-cigarette use, as these are relatively new. Additionally, even the data on e-cigarette use is tough to parse, as different additives, different exposures, and others are just difficult to interpret. Still, the use of e-cigs or other vaping products are associated with this lung condition. It's called e-cigarette or vaping product use associated lung injury, or EVALI, which has been a major concern in recent years with over 2,000 cases in a 2019 CDC report. And that's also going up. The majority of these seem to be due to this vitamin E acetate exposure in the liquid, although there is another commonality with THC exposure in the 3 months preceding presentation for this EVALI condition.
I saw a fair amount of this. This was like the hot topic in pulmonary medicine in like the couple months right before COVID hit. And it was relatively common to see among young patients who vaped to see them come in with pretty bad lung injury, needing supplemental oxygen, sometimes needing ventilators. And then COVID hit and EVALI like disappeared in terms of like how worried people were about it, or how much people were talking about it, because we got swept by a bigger problem.
Well, because the government didn't want you to think about this because they're getting paid off by big vape, right?
There you go.
The bulk of the health data on e-cigarette and vaping use outside of EVALI and prevalence of use has mostly focused on its efficacy in smoking cessation risk and initiating smoking, which we will discuss later. So basically, most of the data is like, hey, if people use e-cigarettes, does that help them quit smoking, for example, or does it actually lead to an increased risk of smoking? So we'll discuss that a little bit later. But I think it's reasonable to say that e-cigarette use is not a healthy behavior in never smokers, particularly at high doses. However, whether this is due to nicotine exposure itself remains unknown. You agree with that take?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going out of my way to encourage non-smokers to start using e-cigarettes. I think that on balance, the current evidence, which it sounds like we'll get to a little bit later, suggests that e-cigarette use may be a tool to facilitate getting people off of smoking tobacco, although the degree of health benefit that they get with that compared with other strategies to get them off of smoking tobacco cigarettes is still not super clear. So,
yeah, you would prefer that people never smoke and not use e-cigarettes. But again, if the question that we're really trying to answer here is like, is nicotine in and of itself some sort of like harmful substance to use regularly? I don't know that the data on vaping and e-cigarette use answers that question.
Yeah, so, I think I'd default back to the long quote that you pulled the other last time on
the Paracelsus quote,
the real Paracelsus quote of the dose makes the poison.
Yeah, we really had to simplify that one. Yeah. For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I got to say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code B-A-R-B-E-L-L to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of my questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so let's move on to smokeless tobacco. Now, this comes in numerous types. There's chewing tobacco. This is cured tobacco, usually in the form of loose leaves. There's dry snuff. That's powdered dry tobacco that's sniffed through the nose. There's moist snuff and snus. These are cut tobacco that can be loose or pouched. This includes dip. And we should also differentiate between these and non-tobacco nicotine products, which are often synthetic nicotine, and then tobacco products when looking at effects. So it's just really, when you're looking at data, just make sure you know kind of what is the mechanism of delivery. What is the vehicle of delivery, rather? In general, smokeless tobacco contains concentrations of nicotine similar to cigarette tobacco, like one can of snuff or one bag of chewing tobacco per week. That's approximately the same amount of nicotine as one pack of cigarettes smoked per day. I don't know that most people who have used smokeless tobacco are aware of that. They're like, oh, I'm just doing one tin per week. It's like, well, that's like a pack a day. And they're like, wait, what? Like, yeah, surprise. This is maybe not that health promoting either. But the prevalence of use is high. The use of smokeless tobacco exceeds that of all other forms of tobacco use in some parts of the world. So for example, 30% of men in India use smokeless tobacco. 6% of men in Iceland use smokeless tobacco, and 20% of men in Sweden use smokeless tobacco. Perhaps more interestingly, the use is very high in athletes. Now, smokeless tobacco has been associated with baseball effectively since its inception. And despite being replaced by smoking in the 1950s in the general public, higher use has basically started in the 1970s and has gone up with more recently, a third of collegiate baseball players and football players report using smokeless tobacco, and close to 35% of Major League Baseball players are being current users. The use of snus amongst Norwegian adolescent athletes is about 17%, although it's more common in team sports and individual athletes. And then in the Finns, a study of about 500 Finnish athletes funded by their National Olympic Committee in 2002, the prevalence of daily snuff use was fivefold that of controls. Being highest in team sports and lowest for endurance athletes. So let's talk about health effects with respect to smokeless tobacco use. Again, it's hard to interpret this data because most of the quality is poor. It's conflated by smoking status. So people who just use smokeless tobacco versus people who use smokeless tobacco and still smoke, that's a confounding factor, but we'll try our best here. With respect to smokeless tobacco itself, not including snus, because people, they make a big deal out of this. It's like, it's not the same, which I agree. So let's talk about just smokeless tobacco. A recent meta-analysis on 20 studies on snuff showed that there was an increased risk of heart disease and stroke mortality. So death from heart disease, death from stroke, by about 10 to 40%, depending on the study and data set, compared to people who never use tobacco. And that's globally. The cancer risk, particularly oral and head and neck cancers, increase in risk, double to triple, depending on the data set, in those using smokeless tobacco compared to never tobacco users. With respect to snus, there are 19 studies where people were using snus only, showed no increased risk of ischemic heart disease. And then there might be a slight risk of all-cause mortality, cancer, and stroke-related mortality, but the confidence interval crossed one, so it's hard to say. That just means that it's a statistical sort of finding that makes you hard to be confident in not only the directionality, if there is a relationship, but also the size of effect. Four recent meta-analyses on snus and heart disease showed little to no association, but there may be an increased risk in mortality from prostate cancer, in addition to an increased risk of asthma, chronic bronchitis, and chronic sinusitis. That's just on snus. So to me, overall, the studies show that basically any increase in death and disease rates associated with the use of snus is much less than that associated with smoking, but I can't really confidently say if there is one. This could be viewed through the lens of harm reduction compared to smoking or smokeless tobacco use, but I don't know that snus is like beneficial. There's two or three studies showing like a decreased risk of Parkinson's disease, and which was a kind of a weird finding, but I'm like, huh, I wonder what the mechanism is there, and has that been replicated in studies outside of Sweden where snus is more commonly sort of consumed? There might be some sort of, I don't know, socioeconomic sort of relationship there or other behavior attached to it. It's just really hard to parse out. In any case, the estimated risk of death is estimated to be about 5% with snus compared to never users, those people who don't smoke, don't use smokeless tobacco, don't use snus. And then for Zyn, they actually did a study on this. The estimated risk is excess death risk is 3.5%. It should be noted that these are made up estimates used on modeling, so it's hard to feel confident in those numbers. But I did want to introduce this kind of idea of there being this like a spectrum of risk based on not only the amount of tobacco or nicotine that somebody's exposed to, but also the vehicle. So like on one side, most severe risk is cigarette smoking. And then on the lowest end is likely something like Zyn, for example, just nicotine. But I don't know, it'd be really hard to say confidently that there's no risk. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think it's likely that there's no risk either. But I also think that the what you are at risk of is going to vary between these things, right? So what specific risks are derived from the use of pure nicotine at a particular dose is going to be substantially different than using an equivalent or even a greater amount of nicotine, but also that comes packaged with burning a bunch of tar and other stuff in the form of cigarette smoking on top of the dosage-related effect. So the risks are variable kind of along multiple dimensions there. You mentioned this maybe association with a reduced risk of Parkinson's disease that like triggered like a vague memory from medical school of apparently smoking also reducing the risk of certain forms of inflammatory bowel disease. I think it was ulcerative colitis or something like that, which I remember us having the conversation at the time, like never going to recommend somebody start smoking to reduce their risk of UC, but same with Parkinson's disease.
And hernias. There's when I did the review on hernias, there was like this pretty reliable finding that those
so
who smoked had a lower risk of hernias. And I'm like, I don't know that I would recommend smoking as a to reduce the risk of hernias. I think I would just take the hernia.
Yeah.
I think in that case. Yeah. Okay. So that's the deal on smokeless tobacco of different forms. Again, the data is not very good. I think what we're coming at this from is that there's likely some increased risk of not only just excess death risk, so all cause mortality, but probably stemming from cardiovascular disease, certain types of cancer. It's likely some increased risk with nicotine exposure, but again, much, much less than smoked tobacco products. So now we're finally on nicotine replacement therapy. So these nicotine replacement products were introduced as aids for smoking cessation in the late 1970s, and they continue to be used extensively in the treatment of tobacco dependence. Now, nicotine replacement therapy is delivered by multiple different ways, which affects qualitatively comparable to cigarette smoking with respect to heart rate and contractility. That just means heart rate goes up and the heart beats a little harder. But there are different forms. So there's long-acting patches that get absorbed transdermally. There's short-acting gum, lozenges, nasal spray. The intake of nicotine with nicotine replacement therapy tends to be lower than what we see in smoking, although you could be like our case that we started out with where the exposure was much, much higher. And in general, long and short acting options are usually used in combination to facilitate quitting. We'll talk about that more here shortly. Now, the risks associated with nicotine replacement therapy with respect to heart disease and related risk factors have been a concern, but establishing a causal relationship between nicotine replacement and cardiovascular events is difficult since nicotine replacement therapy is mostly used by former smokers who tend to have a higher risk of events in general. There are a couple of important studies that kind of highlight this. So there's this lung health study cohort in about 6,000 middle-aged adults with COPD. They compared participants who smoked with those who quit with or without nicotine gum. Now, in that group, comparing those who quit with or without the use of nicotine gum, there was no increase in hospital admission for cardiovascular events with nicotine gum treatment, regardless of the dose being used. And participants who quit smoking successfully and used gum, the nicotine gum, had a lower hospital admission rate for cardiovascular disease than subjects who did not quit smoking. Surprise, surprise. This is, again, harm reduction, right? Mm-hmm. But that still doesn't really answer the question, like, is nicotine exposure in and of itself just completely harmless? Another study of about 600 individuals, mostly men, with at least one diagnosis of cardiovascular disease found no difference in the incidence of primary cardiovascular endpoints. So things like death, heart attack, or admission to the hospital for cardiovascular disease at 14 weeks, if whether they had a placebo or they got nicotine. These are folks who had heart disease already, and then they just randomized them to either get nicotine replacement therapy, even though they weren't smokers, or placebo. So if anything, that speaks in the direction of nicotine kind of being neutral, which I think I'm probably more on board to agree with, that mm-hmm. nicotine is mostly neutral unless the way you're getting it is uniquely harmful or you're taking a lot of it and it has other sort of effects. What do you think about that?
Yeah, route and dose were the main two things that I was thinking about here. I agree with you.
Yeah. So overall, to me, the evidence suggests that the elevated risk of heart attack and stroke associated with cigarette smoking are derived from the chemicals associated with cigarette smoke rather than just the nicotine. The risks of nicotine medication in patients with cardiovascular disease, if any, are much lower than those of continuing smoking, and the benefits of nicotine medication far outweigh the risks of continued smoking in such patients. Again, we can go back to those sort of modeling data we have as far as like, what is the estimated excess risk of death? It's probably close to Zin, maybe a little lower, 2% is what's been estimated. And again, this speaks to the sort of continuum of harm from nicotine containing products with cigarettes on one end and like nicotine replacement products on the other side. But there's just an overall lack of hard evidence for the harms of nicotine alone. And so it's just really hard to feel confident about that relationship.
Yeah, I think that's all reasonable. And it's really, you know, the context that we're talking about it in is what's most applicable. And what I mean by that is nobody is going out, finding people or having a panel of patients who don't smoke, and then for whatever reason, recommending that they start using nicotine replacement therapy. Like pretty much the only context that this is being used clinically is to facilitate smoking cessation. Now, you did mention, of course, that there is plenty of, you know, other use in other ways by athletes and all sorts of other stuff, which we'll get to next in this kind of like performance related discussion. And still, even in that context, I'm not convinced that there's a great degree of harm outside of dosage being a major factor.
Yeah. Yeah. So to your point, with respect to performance, now many athletes have beliefs that nicotine is performance enhancing. So I thought we should take a look at that too. And it's not just their own personal beliefs. They didn't just like conjure this up out of nowhere. People are being told this, mm-hmm. whether it's by a guru, whether it's by somebody influential in their life, or just demonstrated in their sport, particularly like baseball, for example. It is on the monitoring list for the World Anti-Doping Association, WADA. It doesn't mean it's prohibited, but they're monitoring the use. And this came out in 2012 after a study of 42 sports showed that the prevalence of use was 2 times as much in elite athletes compared to an age-matched general population group, plus other studies showing an increased risk of use. With respect to effects that may be related to performance, we'll start out with the heart here. And a number of meta-analyses have addressed these effects. So 16 of 24 studies showed that use of nicotine increased resting heart rate, but 8 reported no change. 2 studies reported that using nicotine decreased heart rate variability. Nobody else measured this, so it's only been investigated twice. With respect to blood pressure, 11 studies showed that there was an increase in systolic and diastolic blood pressure, and 5 studies showed no change. I don't know that I could predict performance based on those sort of findings, especially because the magnitude of effect with respect to the increase in resting heart rate, the decrease in heart rate variability, and increase in blood pressure were overall small. And again, if I thought they were like reliably found, you would see it more consistently, I think. And it would be, you know, alarm bells would just be going off. You're like, well, it increased resting heart rate by 20 beats per minute. Like, nah, we're talking like 2 or 3. And again, when it's been investigated, you really have to suss out, like, are these people current nicotine users versus, and are they like in withdrawal, for example? Or the term they use in the research is nicotine satiated, meaning that they're like, oh, you've recently consumed nicotine, so you're not like during a withdrawal phase right now. So that's how you enter the study in. Kind of interesting. With respect to actual performance outcomes, there's only 3 studies that I could find that had anything to do with muscular strength. They're mostly on knee extension type force production, hand grip strength, things like that. Nobody's saying, hey, what does your 1RM do on a squat if you use nicotine, you know, for 12 weeks?
It's just, I feel like they could have gone to like, you know, go find like an SPF powerlifting meet back in the like 80s and 90s when dudes would hit their third squat and go out to the parking lot to hit a smoke.
You could do it even now. I was in my gym the other day, and this man, okay, so here's the weirdest, so strange. He had squat shoes, like weightlifting shoes out, he had his belt out, right? He had chalk out and a can of Zin. And so I'm like, I wonder what's happening over here. Yeah. The man proceeds to squat without a belt, his barefoot. He's got a squat shoes there, but he's squatting barefoot. And I see him take at least 2 separate times, take a Zin out and put it in. And I'm like, I think if you could just recruit people, yeah. Hey, do you use Zin? Yeah, like, let's enter the study. But yeah, so only 3 studies on muscle strength. 1 showed a small benefit in leg extension strength. 1 showed reduced performance. Interestingly, in people who were using nicotine regularly. So like when they actually came into the study, they were going through what they would call withdrawal. They were not nicotine satiated, and they actually had increased performance when they abstained versus when they actually treated themselves and took nicotine. Yeah. So unexpected finding, but interesting nonetheless. And the one showed no change. So three studies on this, none in like complex dynamic movements. Of 5 studies on endurance, 1 showed a benefit, 4 showed no change. We're actually going to talk about this, the one that showed benefit here a little bit. These are 12 non-smoking men cycling to exhaustion with placebo or nicotine patch. The heart rate response was about the same. But there was no difference in respiratory variables, no difference in the type of fuel that they used. So like carbs versus fat, no significant sweat rate differences, no differences in RPE. And so they actually had an increased performance in the time to exhaustion of about 17%, which is like 8 minutes longer. But because there were no like effects on heart rate, on respiratory rate, sweat rate, anything like that, they think that the effect is likely centrally mediated. So from the brain, similar to caffeine. It's not like caffeine is, you know, working in your muscles to maybe make them contract harder, for example. It seems to be centrally mediated. And so that's on nicotine not related to snus. So nicotine replacement like patches, nicotine gum, for example. Now, this is an interesting study with snus. All right. So these are 14 non-tobacco users. And the two groups, one was placebo and one had snus. Now, the interesting part of this is they kept the snus in during the test. So it's not like they just had it before and then did the test. This was like in while they were doing this cycling test to exhaustion at 65% of their max aerobic capacity. So they're getting 8 milligrams of nicotine just dripped into their system during the test. There was no significant differences in time to exhaustion, RPE, lactate levels, or cardiac response. But I just thought like if I had to predict my own performance, like having some nicotine in, I'd predict it to go down. I don't know, like just the idea, like, yeah, it's just hanging out in your mouth. You'll be fine. I don't know. But they didn't find that.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess it would partially depend on a lot of this being potentially centrally mediated is going to have influence based on your expectations. And then also on like your degree of habituation and tolerance and things like that. So if it's somebody who is used to using it and believes in it and things like that, then these kind of centrally mediated effects can get augmented. Versus and honestly, like if you're a habitual user, also you could probably identify whether you were getting the real deal or if you were getting placebo, if I had to guess. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of interesting factors when you get into kind of sports psychology, the impact of supplements or substances, this whole central governor concept. I remember learning a ton about this, a lot of these concepts in Alex Hutchinson's book called Endure, which was excellent and would recommend for anybody interested in this topic.
Yep. I agree. And again, just to make sure you guys are all aware of this, there's some significant confounding variables here, again, with people who are chronic users, right? So not nicotine naive, for example. It's similar to the idea about caffeine maybe not having as big of an effect because most people have caffeine. And so like a lot of the effects that you might see in some studies are due to like treating withdrawal. But in any case, this particular study took habitual users versus controls who were never users. There's 16 dudes. They did a time trial to exhaustion with cycling at 80% of their VO2 max, and they either got 8 milligrams of nicotine snus or they abstained. So these were all users. When they abstained, they actually had a 13% improvement in time to exhaustion, 4 minutes longer, versus when they actually, again, satiated themselves with nicotine use. So I don't know, even with that sort of withdrawal idea, it seems like people just do better without nicotine, if there's any effect. Mm-hmm. The other thing that people really talk about with respect to nicotine and performance is this sort of cognitive improvement. Like, oh, it's a stimulant. It's going to help you focus, going to help with memory. A lot of smokers cite, you know, that they want to stay focused and that's why they keep smoking. And so when they go to quit smoking and they have this withdrawal, particularly if they're not being treated with nicotine replacement therapy, they're like, I gotta work. Like, how do I quit? There's growing evidence, however, that suggests that the cognitive enhancing effects of nicotine contribute to this difficulty in quitting smoking, especially in individuals with psychiatric disorders, which are overrepresented in those who smoke as well. So some sort of confounding there. That's beyond kind of the scope of this podcast. I'm more interested in like nicotine naive individuals who might hear this from their favorite influencer and be like, I should definitely start using nicotine gum, for example. So there was a meta-analysis that gets cited all the time by Heishman. It's 41 placebo-controlled studies that show that nicotine administration to either non-smokers or satiated smokers showed some small potential benefits in short-term and working memory in addition to alertness. But the effects within or across domains of cognitive function were not dose-dependent, and they were relatively small, of unknown clinical significance. It's like, okay, this was a statistically significant difference, but was it clinically important? Also, sidebar. Do you remember that, was it a post on our forum where somebody had claimed that it was a clinically important difference, but not statistically significant difference?
And we're like, that's not possible.
That's not possible. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So that's kind of like where people are coming at this from. They're like, look, there's a study. It shows there might be some small benefits. But when you look at the effect size and the magnitude of difference, it's just not that reliable, not that big. So to me, like, the evidence demonstrates that nicotine has differential effects on cognition. So it would not surprise me that some folks, upon being administered nicotine, have like a pretty big improvement and other people have no improvement. That seems to jibe with like normal human experience to pretty much everything. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And also probably depends on smoking history, nicotine withdrawal status, and more. I think we overall should view this data on cognitive benefits skeptically, as the majority of studies showing a positive benefit are industry funded. Nicotine overall, to me, doesn't appear to be associated with consistent, robust cognitive performance effects. And, you know, the industry funding thing is difficult to kind of get around here. I don't know that people are, you know, when they look at studies, they're like, big nicotine funded this. It's just part of that biohacking sort of thing, right? It's like, no, it's not big pharma, it's big tobacco. Is that better? Like, where do you think this ranks? Is big pharma worse than big tobacco?
No, I don't really think so. But I also think that tobacco has been on the decline for a while in recent years. I mean, there is a plausible mechanism here, because you mentioned how nicotine hits this acetylcholine receptor. Acetylcholine, if we wanted to reduce it down to like one oversimplistic mechanism, plays a pretty significant role in cognition and brain function. So not terribly surprising that there is an effect that has been identified. Also not surprising that, as we mentioned, with literally almost any intervention that you can apply to humans, there's going to be a spectrum of responsiveness, and then layer on top of that placebo and expectations and things like that, and you're going to get some people who absolutely swear by the stuff, who are maybe getting a big component of placebo, some people who swear by it, who might be getting a bit more of a real like cholinergic signaling effect from this, and then other people who don't get much out of it because of their whatever brain makeup, genetic susceptibility, how their receptors are, you know, set up, something like that. So this is similar to the use of effectively any other substance or intervention, big spectrum of variation, and then a lot of expectancy and placebo stuff that can get layered on top of that.
Yeah. So it's time to talk about quitting smoking, or quitting use of maybe smokeless tobacco as well. And so there are three major side effects that people seem to get when they quit smoking or use of smokeless tobacco: weight gain, withdrawal, depression, and anxiety, and then cough. That's usually just related to smokers, however. So the weight gain is actually pretty common. In a meta-analysis of 62 studies, untreated quitters, these are people not getting nicotine replacement therapy, for example, they're kind of doing it on their own, they went cold turkey, they gain an average of 4.6 kilograms at 1 year after quitting. Most of this happened in the first 3 months, and this is thought to be due to effects of nicotine on appetite. It appears to be a mild appetite suppressant. Also seems to be due to a reduced basal metabolic rate. Nicotine seems to increase basal metabolic rate, and overall subsequent changes in food behaviors. But there's a large distribution within these sort of average findings. So out of 100 people who quit smoking, 16 of them will actually lose weight in the next year. A third of them will more or less maintain their weight. Another third will gain somewhere between, again, 5 to 10 kilos, and 13% will gain more than that. Now, this can be counteracted with, to some degree, by treatment with medications. So for example, treating with either nicotine replacement therapy, so like Nicorette gum, for example, reduces weight gain. So does treatment with bupropion, Wellbutrin, can reduce weight gain. And so same thing with varenicline, which can also reduce weight gain. So I know people do go cold turkey, you know, and I did look into some data on like what's the rate of success. It tends to be much lower when people go cold turkey, although I don't know that I would dissuade somebody from trying to quit on their own either. If somebody's super motivated and they're like, I'm quitting today, I'm not going to stand in their way. But I would offer myself for additional resources with respect to quitting. What do you think about that?
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, if you're in the clinician's seat and you have a patient who's super motivated to quit, that is a luxurious position to be in, because that is not necessarily the norm. More often you're having to, you know, facilitate that behavior change, which can be difficult. And, you know, even though there are some obvious differences between managing smoking and managing like obesity, for example, there are also a lot of parallels in terms of the difficulty of doing it, the high amount of RPE that is required to get off cigarettes and stay off them, as there is with initiating and maintaining a change in dietary kind of behavior and physical activity and things like that. And so in the same way that, you know, in previous episodes, we've talked about the use of, you know, medical interventions, medication, surgery, et cetera, to facilitate, you know, successful behavior change, treatment of obesity, successful long-term sustained weight loss by making the behaviors basically easier to adhere to, lowering that effort that is required in the short and long term. these interventions for smoking cessation achieve similar types of effects. So as mentioned earlier, a lot of the nicotine replacement or other types of therapies, we typically combine some form of a long-acting treatment like bupropion, like varenicline, potentially like nicotine patches to kind of suppress that on a steady, longer-term basis. And then for breakthrough kind of cravings in between, using some form of a shorter-acting nicotine replacement product like gums or lozenges, for example. And then those, of course, can significantly increase the rate of successful quitting. But at the same time, I still have these conversations, you know, with patients and set expectations that, hey, it's awesome. We're gonna do this, but not putting all of the weight on this initial attempt to quit smoking, because a large portion of folks going through this end up needing multiple tries to achieve it successfully. That's quite common. And so, you know, the more it's like if you have a lifter that you're coaching and they have all of their hopes and dreams and everything set on, you know, crushing it at their first powerlifting meet. And you're like, bro, we need to set some better expectations that, you know, if you miss a rep, like the world is not crashing down on you. Similar sorts of thing. Like this is great. We're going to attack it with everything we got, but it is not unusual to need multiple tries. And that's a good way to facilitate kind of longer term success here.
Yeah. It's interesting too. I mean, there's a lot of overlap here with the obesity management, for example, even with the problem in and of itself, right? And so, you know, right now, 14.5%-ish of adults are smokers in the United States, and it's not from lack of knowledge, right? And so it's like already there's some parallels here, because individuals suffering from overweight or obesity it's not due to a lack of knowledge. Right. So you have all these people like, did you know that eating vegetables are more healthy than eating like, ultra processed foods? And you're like, oh man, wow. You just totally changed my life. And you're like, so what do I do about that? And they're like, yeah, man, just try harder. You know? And you're like, oh yeah, I never thought about actually trying. I'll try that. And so not only like the initial problem is not a fund of knowledge problem, it's a behavioral issue. And that behavioral issue is complex. There's environmental stuff going on. There's genetic stuff going on. It's just more difficult than knowing what to do. The actual, like what you want people to do is relatively simple. Oh, we want individuals suffering from obesity to eat in an energy deficit to achieve a healthy body composition and body weight and ultimately have a greater health trajectory. Great. We want individuals who are smoking currently to not smoke. All this stuff is like that's straightforward, but the act of doing it is the more complex thing. So that's why some of these medications, the behavioral therapy, the motivational interview, and all that stuff kind of helps you navigate that. And again, to your point, it's not just like a one and done, like, yep, did my job, go with God. See you in a year when you're all set and done. So I do think this is a good time, though, to bring up the electronic cigarette sort of discussion again, because despite knowledge by clinicians that, yep, we should do motivational interviewing and behavior change counseling and combining that with pharmacotherapy plus or minus nicotine replacement therapy. But they know that. Well, what about also maybe using electronic cigarettes, for example? There's some substantial evidence here showing that electronic cigarettes can help with smoking cessation. The problem is that there's some like risk on the back end where people will just keep doing that, you know, in perpetuity rather than like getting off that. You could make the counter argument that, well, look, the options are either to like convert to electronic cigarette use and then keep doing that or just keep smoking. Yeah, it's probably more beneficial to do the electronic cigarettes. But in the perfect world, you would use short-term sort of exposure with electronic cigarettes to fully replace their current cigarette smoking and then gradually wean off that. The other issue with electronic cigarettes is obviously people who start doing that out of nowhere who otherwise weren't smoking, that actually can lead to smoking-related behaviors. So I think the evidence is
an on-ramp instead of as an off-ramp.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. And that may be seen in people who are trying to quit smoking too. It's like, it just, you're maintaining some of the behaviors that are ultimately is going to be difficult to kind of like get off completely. Ultimately, I think we all wanted health promotion. And so this could be a mechanism or a method rather of harm reduction. But most people will say it's not their first choice when they do this from a clinical standpoint. Have you advised anybody on e-cigarette use? Have you seen anybody like that in the hospital? Had that issue come up?
Yeah, so it's a bit tougher. I typically do initiate these conversations from a hospital standpoint when I have a patient who's at least open to quitting, and I tend to more often prescribe them the medications like varenicline, for example, to facilitate getting people to quit smoking. It's less often that I'm specifically advising them to use electronic cigarettes instead. When that sometimes comes up as a question from the patient, as do you think that would be better, then I tend to you know, lean in slight favor of that, saying it's probably better than continuing to smoke, but still continuing to frame the discussion of, like, you know, to just being quite clear that the ultimate goal should be to get off of this entirely. And if they're in recognition and agreement of that, and they want to pursue that, then I don't, you know, shut that idea down, but rather I just keep framing it around a tool rather than like a permanent, let's just do this forever instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I think that it's a good place to wrap this up here. Okay. So let's summarize. So from a health standpoint, I think we try to make it pretty clear that there's appears to be this continuum of potential harm of nicotine-containing products, with like the inhaled tobacco products, cigarettes on the one end, maximal harm, as it were, and then like nicotine replacement products on the other side. So if it's 100% risk with cigarette smoking, it's maybe 2% risk with nicotine replacement therapy, 2.5% with like Zyn, 5% with snus. These are all made up numbers, but I'm just trying to give people a lay of the land. Overall, there's just a lack of hard evidence here, so it's really difficult to feel confident in those numbers. But I think conceptually, that's how I would frame it. I think it'd be difficult to suggest that nicotine ingestion in and of itself is innocuous, completely just irrelevant to any sort of harm. I think most favorably, you could view it as kind of neutral to potentially harmful. I feel like that's a charitable take for nicotine, but I think that's as far as I might be willing to go. If we said you're only going to get this from nicotine replacement therapy, maybe Zyn, something like that, and the dose overall is relatively low. On the other side, the risk of like it leading to potentially, you know, worse behaviors. So maybe you start with the nicotine replacement therapy and you're like, oh, I kind of like this. And then you move to smokeless tobacco and whatever, or, you know, you move to e-cigarettes or something like that. That seems like a net negative. And I think the further you kind of work your way up that continuum, the worse the health outcomes are likely to be. But to me, the big question is why? Like, why are you doing this? If it's like personal enjoyment, like, hey man, like, look, we all have our things. I get that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I could make a strong argument or even like a moderate argument for exercise performance, for cognitive performance, anything like that. It would just really have to be like, no, my personal preference is to do this, right? It's kind of like, to me, it's almost like alcohol intake, right? I think the majority of people would be healthier if they drank less or didn't drink at all. But I'm not a teetotaler. Like, look, if people want to have some drinks, that's fine. I think there's, you know, responsible use. But I don't think I would start somebody drinking alcohol.
You should definitely start drinking, yeah.
Yeah, for some sort of benefit, right? It's like the idea of saying, oh, there's some benefit on performance from alcohol and it's reliable across everybody. I'm like, that's more than a stretch. Same sort of thing with cognitive performance. I feel similarly about nicotine. I don't know. Do you have another take on that?
Yeah. I mean, I would approach the conversation similarly. There's effectively no clinical context where I'm interacting with a patient where I'm recommending that they initiate any of these behaviors. Rather, it's typically a way of how can we de-escalate this behavior and what tools do we need to get there and how urgent is it that we get there?
I love it. All right. That's a wrap here on episode 285 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Everything you wanted to know about nicotine plus some extra gems. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for giving us his time. Excellent job on the case, the mystery case. You did it again. Your batting average continues to soar.
Very good.
Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.